Thank you so much for joining me today. This is Hashtag No Limits, and I am your host, Shelley Kino. Hashtag No Limits is about people who society places limits upon, but who are busting through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, "We know who we are, but not who we will be," and I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a better or more beautiful example of that than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. The caterpillar literally dissolves into cells and then reforms into the butterfly, and that's not done. It still has to struggle to get out of the cocoon in order to be strong enough to fly wherever it wants to go. While that is not easy, certainly doesn't sound easy at least, neither is busting through the limits that society places upon people. And today I am so very happy to share my, I can now call her a colleague, Bev Johns. She is someone who has taught me so much about behaviors and understanding behaviors and working with those unwanted behaviors and how to manage my classroom. And I'm thrilled to have her here. So make sure you like and subscribe. If you do watch this in live, give me a hashtag live and where you're from. If you watch it in replay, a hashtag replay and where you're from. And if you have any questions or comments for Bev or I, put them in the chat and I will put them up on the screen. Enough from me. Bev, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, I am delighted to be here and to chat about behavior, my favorite topic. That's for sure.
Yeah, I think that's probably my favorite or close to my favorite topic to talk about. And so I don't know if you caught when I said at the intro that it's those unwanted behaviors. Is that how you refer to behaviors or how, what is your way of talking about those behaviors that get kids in trouble?
Well, I think it is the unwanted behaviors that some of our children engage in, but my whole premise is we have to look at why that child is engaging in unwanted behaviors by the adult, because mm-hmm. they may be behaviors that are serving a purpose for the child. And the secret is for us to figure out what purpose the behavior is serving for the child, so that if we right. don't like the behavior, then if we work to meet that child's needs in another way, it's a win-win for the adult and for the child, because the child is having their needs met and the adult is understanding more about why the child is doing what they're doing.
Right. Exactly. I say exactly because, I mean, you've taught me that, but also other people have taught me that. I've learned that myself. And so I'm sure there will be a lot of me nodding and agreeing, 100% with you throughout this afternoon. But go ahead. And I kind of jumped ahead. Go ahead and introduce yourself and tell the audience who you are and what your experience, how long you've been around special ed, and just give us a brief history of what brought you here today.
Okay, well, my name is Bev Johns, and I have worked with children with the most significant behavior problems for many years, and I will tell you the story of how I got involved in the field, because as so many of us know, to get through college, we have to work our way through college. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I worked my way through college working with children who had already been adjudicated delinquent at the ages of 9 to 14. And wow. they were in a facility run by juvenile detention in Kentucky. And I got to know those children. I really liked working with the children. A lot of them were, as I would describe, were victims of a system mm-hmm. that had not been successful for them. So I became interested in working with children with behavior problems at that time. So the field of behavior disorders was brand new then. And I applied. I was going to school in Kentucky, and I applied for a fellowship to come to Illinois to SIU Carbondale, to get a graduate degree in emotional and behavioral disorders. They were trying to train people because they realized even back then that there was going to be a tremendous need. So there were five of us that were selected for those fellowships. And so I came to Illinois as a result of that and did graduate work at SIU Carbondale. Well, then when I had finished my master's degree and I stayed on and I took a lot of courses in applied behavior analysis with a wonderful professor named Beth Sulzer Azaroff. And she was fabulous. She taught me the importance of being positive with children, just a lot of the key concepts that I learned from her. So I finished my degree in December, and the university had a position at their day school for emotionally disturbed children who were emotionally disturbed at the time. And they said, would you be interested in applying? And I thought, oh, sure. I can do this. I've got all of these graduate hours. I finished my master's degree. Not a problem. How hard can it be to work with seven children? And I found out how hard it was to work with seven children. And keep in mind, I did not have a paraprofessional at the time.
Wow.
I learned quickly that you really do need a paraprofessional because I couldn't go to the bathroom all day long because there was nobody
exactly
around who was going to watch the children that were in my classroom. And I remember going home with bite marks and scratches, and I had been spit on, et cetera. And I thought, my gosh, what have I gotten myself into? And I always say that I have the case of the dangling earring because one day I was a brand new young teacher and I wanted to go to school looking my very best. And I did, but nobody had told me in a training program, do not wear dangly earrings if you're going to work with children with behavior problems. Well, what do I wear? My big dangly earrings. And little Jimmy, who loved to bite, scratch, kick, pull hair, you name it. He had this whole repertoire of behaviors. So anyway, he pulled my ears. And he pulled the ear. And then after a number of years, it finally just, it's totally slid all the way out. And I always say to people will say, why don't you just get your ear fixed? Well, I'm a cheapskate. My car, you know, a bit of a coward. So I never did that. So it just reminds me of those practical things we need to and be prepared for. So anyway, I had a little girl in my classroom and her name was Sally. And I wrote an article about Sally sits on my shoulders because she does. And she does to this day, even though Sally is grown. But Sally was 10 years old and she was coming to my class for the first time at the age of 10.
Wow.
And what happened was her family lived in Southern Illinois, and her mother had 10 children, and Sally had an unrepaired cleft palate. She had cerebral palsy. She had cognitive disabilities. She had behavior problems. She had a whole repertoire of behaviors that some people would say were unwanted behaviors, but bless her heart, Sally was a dear. I loved her dearly. So anyway, Sally's mother in the small community in which they lived would take Sally to school every year along with her other children, trying to register Sally for school. And of course, the building principal would take a look at Sally, who also walked with a limp, and said, she can't come to school. Take her home. And this went on from kindergarten until Illinois passed a law that said all children had the right to go to school. And so because Illinois is a state that I'm very proud to say had a law that said all children had the right to go to school before we had public law 94-142. So she came to school at 10. Now, think about all of the wonderful opportunities she missed with early intervention, getting speech and language, all of those things. And she had an unrepaired cleft palate, and we were able to get her. And I went with a mother to Barnes in St. Louis, and her cleft palate was repaired. And she really
It was fabulous.
And she made a lot of progress. But all I could think of was, oh, if we just could have gotten her at the age of three or even in birth through two program. Right. But when people say, oh, well, we've always had those special ed laws and we always will have those special ed laws. No, I lived it. I know what happened to Sally because she did not have the right to go to school. And Sally really has driven my advocacy work. You know, I love to work with school behavior problems, and I also love to do advocacy work, as you do as well, because I don't want to ever see that happen to another child. So it was a very, you know, sad story that a child had to wait until she was 10 years old to go to school. So that's just a little bit of my background. And so I've continued my work working with children with significant I also was a professional fellow at McMurray College, and so trained teachers to work with students who have behavioral and emotional needs. So that's just a little bit about my path coming into the career. And people always say, you know, if you had to do over, would you do something different? Absolutely not. Because, you know, along the way, I've had the privilege of learning from a lot of children and learning from a lot of families who wanted the best for their children, as any parent would.
Right. And I am so thankful. So there was so much that you said in there. I'm gonna let you take a breath, get a drink if you need to. But there were so many things that you said. So first of all, I'm so glad that you decided to come to Illinois from Kentucky and go to SIUC. And at one time in the world of special education in Illinois, you could get separate degrees. So you could get your degree specifically in learning disabilities, or you could get your degree specifically in behavioral, emotional behavioral disturbed, or you could get in the, what we used to call the educably mentally and trainable mental handicapped. And then around the early 2000s, Illinois changed that law. And now when a special ed teacher comes out of school, they're certified in everything K through 12. But they might be certified, but they don't necessarily know what they need to know as much as when those were separated out, and they were, because you then had your concentrations in that particular area. And when I started getting my degree, that was the path I was going on, was I was going on the path of getting the LD and the BD. And then my path was interrupted. My husband and I married and we moved overseas, and then we had a child. And by the time I came back to finish that degree, they were getting ready to switch and said, you know, you got to finish and, but we're going to move your degree over into this all encompassing learning behavioral specialist degree that they have now. And so that makes it, I think, more daunting on our special ed teachers now, because you don't have the knowledge that you need in a lot of the situations, but yet the school that hires you, the parents whose children walk into your classroom, expect you to have all of that knowledge. And it's, I think it's so, so difficult. And the story that you tell about your earring, I have a chapter in my book, Those Who Can't Teach. It's Alan's chapter, and he experienced something similar where he was a kid who, you know, had arms going every which way and legs when he would be in full meltdown. And he had a teacher who refused to not wear dangly earrings and necklaces. And her response was, Well, he needs to learn to control himself. And I said, well, we're working on that. But in the meantime, it's better for you if you don't wear the dangly stuff. Well, about two thirds of the way through the school year, she lost a very beautiful necklace. And she blamed the child and she wanted the child to and the family to pay for the necklace. And I said, I'm not even going to ask them because we told you at the beginning of the school year, this was not in your best interest. And while he is getting better, he's just not there yet. And for you to ignore something that you could have done that would have been very simple, that you could control, and say he needed to have control over something that he could not get control over yet, was very, very disappointing to me. And I'm so thankful for the knowledge that I have learned from you and from Dr. Crowley and Dr. Van Acker and just kind of, you know, all the different people throughout my life. And I didn't go to any of the colleges where you taught. It was all because of going to conferences and workshops that you were presenting and that I was able to join and get your expertise for an hour, 2 hours, however many of your sessions I could fit in. And so I feel like we need more of that for our teachers today because they are coming out with such a broad spectrum to have to cover. So tell us a little bit more because ABA, and you talked about that, it gives a lot of people a bad taste in their mouth when they hear ABA. So tell kind of how you've seen it change.
Okay. Well, I think when we were first utilizing applied behavior analysis, some people used it very mechanically and wasn't humanistic and it wasn't natural and it didn't always have the excitement and enthusiasm in it that we needed for children. So along the way, what I have seen happen through the years is the ways of teaching benefited me so much from applied behavior analysis, you know, like fading and shaping and backward chaining and reinforcing successive approximations, which was one of the things I talked about Saturday. Those teaching strategies and positive reinforcement, those teaching strategies formed my whole career, but I also added the humanistic element to it so that it was never mechanical or rote for me. Right. So I always, you know, believed in doing it with a lot of feeling and a lot of positive feeling toward the children.
And I was similar in my approach because I took things from ABA and from Crisis Prevention Institute.
Exactly.
And I kind of developed my own behavioral plan. And some of the things when I lived in England, I had the opportunity to work in the schools in England as well as on the military base. So the American schools as well as the English schools and, you know, the knowledge that I learned in those places as well. And kind of just developed a system for me that worked. And I now take a lot of key components from that. And that's what I teach with when I am now teaching at these seminars and workshops. And it surprises me how many people have never heard of Crisis Prevention Institute. You know, and usually I'm talking to teachers. I'm like, how do you not know about that? Like, you need to find whether it's that or SAFE. What was it that Michelle talked about, or not Michelle, Lisa talked about, safe plans?
Right, safe places, safe spaces. And I then go further and I say brave spaces, a place where not only does a child feel physically and emotionally safe, but feels brave enough to know that they're going to be accepted in mm-hmm. an environment and no one is going to put them down. So, yeah, and I think along the way, we all learn to take a little bit of everything. Like I also was trained in life space intervention. And all of those things we use and we apply them to what an individual child needs. But our, you know, our functional behavior assessment came out of applied behavior analysis saying you have to look at the purpose and what purpose the behavior serves for a child as well. And so some of our interventions are not with some children. And that's one of the issues we see is people will say, well, by golly, I'm going to use this. Well, is it working? Mm-hmm. No. All right. If it isn't working, first you're going to ask, are you implementing the intervention with fidelity?
Right.
Well, no, then it isn't going to work. But the second thing is mm-hmm. maybe it's not appropriate for that child. That's why I am a firm believer that every educator has to be a lifelong learner and has to soak up all of the knowledge base that is now out there that has been built up over the years. Because I think when I first started teaching, we didn't know enough back then about the sensory needs of children and how if their sensory needs were not being met, if they were overstimulated or they're understimulated, that would impact their behavior. And along the way, we have learned so much. And now we have a lot more occupational therapists involved with our children. And then we have learned through a lot of research the link between behavior and language. And therefore, we need our speech and language therapist involved. But my point is, I think that when teachers go into a classroom and don't continue professional development, they are making a big mistake. Because I always say to people, if you hear somebody say, I have all the answers, I don't have anything else to learn, run the other way. Because nobody ever has all of the answers. And we have to be lifelong learners. If we're not, we're not going to be successful with children and families. So, you know, I think about the workshop on Friday. Did I hear things I didn't know before? Absolutely. Yep. Which only show I don't have all of the answers. None of us do. And that's why we have to work with people. And I always say we have to be good detectives because we have to try to figure out why a child is doing what they're doing. And now in the world where we know a lot more about trauma, because some years ago we didn't even talk about the impact that trauma had on children. And now we know more. And so we not only have to continue to read everything we can get our hands on, but we've got to get out with other people and, you know, find out what is happening and brainstorm possible strategies that might be effective for a child rather than just saying, well, I just don't know what to do with them anymore. Well, our children coming into schools now are very complex. They have multiple needs, and sometimes we just want a quick solution. And the bottom line is there really isn't a quick solution. Yeah. We've got to be very thoughtful in our approach, and we have to do a thorough assessment of the child. And we have to collaborate with other people because sometimes we get too close to a situation, mm-hmm. whether it's as a teacher or a parent, and we can't see what we may be doing that might be impacting the behavior of the child. It's so good, you know, because I always say, if you're having trouble with a child, the first place you need to look is yourself. And sometimes that's hard for us. The lady insisted on wearing the necklace. Could she have prevented a lot of issues? Not giving those temptations to that child when she knew that it was just too tempting for the child. So a lot of times we have to look at ourselves. And sometimes that's difficult for us because it's easier to blame the child than say, oops, maybe I'm not utilizing what works for this individual child.
Right. Yeah. And I have seen that so often in classrooms and in my own settings. One of the greatest lessons I think I learned while living in England was the teacher, we had a student who had the really big behaviors, you know, tearing up the rooms, tearing things off the walls, knocking bookshelves over, eloping. I mean, just about every behavior that you could think of. And this was a 5-year-old and he was terrorizing the classroom and the school. And the special ed teacher tried multiple interventions, as you do. You know, you can't work on all the behaviors. You have to work on one at a time.
Right.
And we got down to, you know, him just still having the really big explosive episodes several times a week, sometimes in a day. And she said, I don't know what else to try. Like, I've tried all these different things. And she said, I need to get help from an outside source. And that I felt was such a great lesson to me at the time. I was a paraprofessional, and to have someone acknowledge that I bet there's something else out there that could help this kid, but I've done my best, but my best isn't all there is. And I think that's something we have to help teachers understand is, because I hear that all the time. Well, I want the best for your child. I'm doing everything I can. I understand that and I appreciate that. But everything you can is not everything that is. And it's not a degrading comment. Nobody knows everything.
Exactly. And we have to admit that. And sometimes, though, for some people, that's hard because, first of all, we take the behavior of the job personally.
Right.
And, you know, that's, you know, one of our big mistakes. You know, they call us a name. Right. We say, well, you know, how dare he do that? Well, we can't take the behavior personally. That child is hurting in some way. But that is very hard for people. And, you know, Rick Van Acker says, our work with children with behavioral challenges is labor intensive. And yes, it is. I mean, we have to work hard to help children. And we have to realize we don't ever have all of the answers. And we have to seek assistance. That's why one of the things that we do in the Illinois Council for Children with Behavioral Disorders is we run a Solution Sunday, which when we want to keep children, we want to keep teachers and staff in the field. And sometimes they just get to the breaking point and they say, I've tried everything. Like you said, I've tried everything and it just isn't working. So we say, and there are a number of us that volunteer our time on Sunday after, and we say, you're having a problem with a child, bring it to us on Zoom, safe and brave space. We're not going to go out and talk about it afterwards, but bring it to us, you know, and we'll put our minds at work too to help you. But people need those resources because I get very frightened when I hear people walking off jobs because we have high turnover in the field. Well, when we have that high turnover in the field, we can't build relationships with children, and we have to build positive relationships with children. But if the children are sitting there never knowing when the teacher's going to walk off the job, which is the reality that's going on in some school districts, they can't trust the adult. Think about it. So those things are really presenting us a challenge now. And I think we have children with many more complex needs now.
Yes.
And so it takes a number of people to help and to support that teacher or the parent or whomever is working with the child. We need to support them rather than criticize them and say, right. How can we help you? Kind of like what we do with the children, rather than saying, oh, for crying out loud, that work is so easy, you ought to be able to get it done. No,
right.
It's not easy for them. How can I help you with it? Just that simple sentence can make a huge difference. And that's what educators and parents need as well. Well, how can I help you with this? How can we work together to make this better?
Right. And how do we get to that in our schools when so many administrators in schools have zero knowledge about special education? How do we get, you know, I feel like that's a lot of where the problem comes from, is that administrators don't know the answer and they won't admit that they don't know the answer. And they just kind of either poo-poo the situation, or they put it back on the teachers, or they make the environment such that you don't feel, as an educator, you can go to the administrator and say, you know, I'm struggling in this area. Can I get some professional development specifically for this? Or can I, you know, have some time when I have a sub in my classroom and two or three other teachers have subs and we can collaborate together? Have you found that? And when you worked at McMurray, and how can you address that?
Right. We, some years ago, a couple of colleagues and I did a survey of over 800 teachers of students with emotional and behavior problems in the United States and Canada. And we looked at why people leave the field. Mm-hmm. And the number one reason they were leaving the field was lack of administrative support. So
I can see that.
We presented this data. And so we had principals who said, well, we want to support them, but we don't know what to do, because in some cases they didn't have the answers. So, right. So we looked at what was it that the administrators could do, and the teachers were looking at, they wanted the administrator to trust them. Mm. Little things like giving them a key, right, to get in their room before school starts, which everybody, you know, most people want, because I want to get in my classroom and get my classroom,
absolutely,
set up. But it ended up also, it got more complex, because then when we did the follow-up work, the administrators were kind of choosing to ignore this, some of the special ed teachers, and not all administrators, but administrators who did not have a background in special education were thinking, oh, okay, that's a special ed teacher. He or she knows what they're doing. We'll just leave them alone. Mm-hmm. They thought that was being nice, but the teacher perceived it as, he or she doesn't care enough about me to ask me, right, how things are going in my classroom. So, right, it's a, you know, it is a complicated issue, but I think the best thing that administrators can do is the reaching out to help and support. And what is it that you need so that you can do your job? I think that's really very, very important. We don't want people walking off the job. And something as simple as, you know, saying to a teacher, if you feel like you have to have a break, is there a system to call to say, can somebody relieve me for 10 minutes? And so the, right, teacher can go leave the classroom and kind of pull themselves back together. We do those things for children. We right, need to do them for staff. And the other thing is, we cannot blame the teachers.
Right.
That's, you know, that's one of the things I see. Well, if that teacher was just a better teacher, she wouldn't be having problems with this student. Well, maybe that teacher, you know, needs some support, needs to go to a professional development session.
Right.
needs to have the chance, you know, to read a book, needs somebody to relieve them for a short amount of time. So those little things that an administrator can do can make a positive difference rather than playing what I call the blame game, where, well, let's just blame the teacher over this. And sometimes, you know, people get so involved in and get negative about a child that they can't stop and pause and think, just like with the teacher, let's look at what's going well. And if we switch gears and say, all right, what is this that's going well? And can we build on what is going well?
Yeah. Yeah, I have heard so many times that, you know, a teacher has tried everything that they can think of with disciplining, with, you know, trying to form the relationship, with, you know, being there for the student, helping the student, and the student, you know, still has a, you know, and they've given them, you know, okay, we work through this situation, you get another chance. Okay, we work through that situation, you get another chance. And then they finally get to the point where they feel like they've tried everything that they can, and this child's just not responsive to them. And so they send them to the administration. And then 5 minutes later, the administration sends them back and they have a lollipop. I mean, it's not always a lollipop, but, you know, that's the thing. It's like they come back and they're all happy and they have a lollipop. And now I'm still having to deal with this kid. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is what you and I have I still don't know that we understand it completely, but we have a better understanding that there is a function of the behavior. Behavior is communication. Something is underneath all these behaviors, and we don't have to wait until a child is in full meltdown mode to address those underlying issues. And a functional behavioral assessment is great when done properly, when done by a team of people, and when we don't stop at just saying, oh, it's attention seeking, oh, it's a sensory need, oh, it's access to tangibles. But why is it those things? And how can we address those issues? If it's attention seeking, I hear so many teachers, you know, oh, they just want attention from their peers. Why do they want attention from their peers? And I think we need to do a better job at the college and university level of explaining and training our administrators to have the knowledge so that when they are in those buildings and they are faced with a teacher who's having those difficulties, they can be that support. But like I said, I just think, and you mentioned it too, that so many administrators have zero special ed background. And so they just don't know that it's not just the kids that are in special ed that have behaviors.
That's right.
And all teachers, all administrators should go through, in my opinion, understanding behavior kinds of classrooms, not behavior management, but understanding the behavior. Because if all we're doing is managing a behavior, we're just managing symptoms and we're not getting to the root cause.
And I think also we have to look at the complex relationship between behavior and academics. And that's why I value my training was also in learning disabilities and behavior. But I think sometimes we don't understand that. I have used the example that I was called into a school where the parent lost their job. And why did the parent lose her job? Because by October, she had been called into the school to take her child home 15 days. October.
Wow.
Now, what happened was, and you were saying, oh, they can't suspend. Well, they did, unfortunately. And so I went in and I looked at this, at the situation, and the school had really gotten too close to the situation to see what was going on. But the teacher had kept a log. And when you read the log, this is what was happening. The teacher loved writing. I love writing. And the teacher started every day with a written journal. The children had to write in the written journal.
I can already see where this is going.
This particular child had a learning disability in the area of written expression, and it was a pretty significant learning disability in the area of written expression. So he'd come into the classroom and she'd say to the class, everybody take out their journals and I want you to write on X topic, something that happened last night or whatever. And the kid, first of all, he'd put his head down. He'd just kind of ignore and hope that maybe the teacher wouldn't see. He was in fifth grade. So he just put his head down. Well, then the teacher would go over and the teacher would start what I call nagging and saying, come on, you got to do the journal. Come on, you got to do the journal, on and on and on and on. Well, so until he would take the journal and he would throw it on, rip it up, throw it on the floor and say, F you. And the teacher then would say, okay, that's it. I don't tolerate that in my classroom. Go to the office. Well, in the office, we know what it's like first thing in the morning. I mean, it's where the action is. So the child is messing with stuff on the secretary's desk. And the secretary thinks, wait a minute, I don't get paid enough to deal with this. And she said, she says to the, goes in and says to the principal, who's also in some other kind of crisis, you're going to have to deal with this. So the principal, you know, comes out, takes the child in the office and tries to talk to the child, to which the child tells the principal what he can do in his spare time. And it wasn't readable. And so the principal would say, that's it. We do not talk to people like that in this school. I'm calling your mother and your mother is coming and getting you. Okay. I don't have to do the journal, do I?
Yep.
I mean, exactly. The school, though, was so close to the situation, they could not see what was going on. So we had to go, you know, I would go in and talk, you know, and talk with them and say, you know, is there another way he can do the journal? Can he draw? Can he be with a special ed teacher, you know, and dictate the journal? Something like that. But and we're working with children with behavior problems. The first thing we have to realize is we don't start the day with something they don't do well, because we set the tone for a really bad day. But they just couldn't see it until, you know, we started processing what had happened. And it was related to a learning disability. I was in another IEP and somebody said, oh, well, the child is having trouble, so we need to have him do written reflection of his behavior. I said, and he has a written expression problem.
Oh, yeah, that will help.
Can't do. I mean, what do you think is going to happen? He's going to act up more.
Right.
But you couldn't always see that. So you really have to look. Or I can't tell you the number of times I've been called into classes where it's mathematics. You know, and they're doing hard work. Or in the case of this one child, the teacher wasn't giving enough examples. So she'd lecture. She'd give one example and then say, and now it's time you're to do it. The kid wasn't going to do it. She wanted him referred for behavior. It was an issue with mathematics.
Right.
Let's look at how we're giving him the task to do. So that's what I say. The complexity is, you know, is difficult sometimes for people to understand. Just because something is surface doesn't mean that's really what's going on with the child.
Right. And I hear that so often. I get people who will call me teachers, parents, neighbors of kids, whatever. And they'll say, you know, well, and they'll give me one brief little scenario and they'll say, tell me how to fix that or tell me how to address that. And I can't. And I, well, I could, but I won't, because I need a whole lot more information than just a tiny little snippet for the exact reason you said, all the complexities. What's the environment like when this is happening? What happened right before it? What kind of consequence does the child get afterwards? What's, you know, what's going on that maybe is affecting that, you know, and everybody, we all want quick fixes, and especially when it's behaviors, we want those unwanted behaviors fixed, done, and we're not going to have to deal with them anymore, but they're not that way.
That's right. There are no quick fixes. I mean, because of the complexity of children And now with what we call the comorbidities. So, you know, the child might have ADHD, but the child might also have obsessive compulsive disorder. Then again, the child might also be depressed. Then again, the child might have anxiety. I mean, and then again, the child might have a learning disability. So it's complex. That's why I also say to schools and teachers, never shortchange an assessment. Because a strong evaluation is only going to help you better understand what's going on with the child.
Yeah.
And so if we don't have those good evaluations, we can't really meet the needs of the child.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. We can't just put a Band-Aid on it. We have to see what we need. You know, do we need surgery? Do we need antibiotics? Mm-hmm. What else do we need? The Band-Aid is not going to fix it.
Right.
So you told a story at the conference last week about the burned toast. And I really appreciated that story. Would you mind sharing that today?
Well, it's the whole notion of how our attitude and our ability to emotionally regulate ourselves depending upon how we look at something. So, you know, we get up in the morning and by golly, we were so looking forward to our piece of toast and we burned the piece of toast. So we can either say, well, that's okay. I really didn't want a piece of whole wheat toast. Now I can have a piece of rye toast because that's what I'd rather have. Or, gee, now I can fix another piece of toast and I can have some jelly on it and I like jelly better. Or we can say, oh, no, is this the way the day's going to go? It's just all going to be messed up. We fly off the handle and we don't regulate ourselves because we don't tend to put things in perspective. And a lot of our children, you know, who have significant behaviors, I use the example of road rage, you know, out there. Something happens and people fly off the handle rather than, you know, saying, well, it's okay. So maybe I'll learn to take a shortcut or a different way rather than getting so angry about things. So it's just an activity that you can do with children to say, all right, this happened. But maybe there was really something good that happened as a result of it, rather than saying, it ruined my whole day.
Right.
You know, I burned the toast. Well, I don't have anything to eat. And I, you know, I'm going to be late for school. And we go on and on and on because a lot of children, as adults do, catastrophize events. You know, they make them a lot worse. So just looking at the piece of burned toast, is there a positive way to look at that rather than flying off the handle? And the more that we can practice those things with children, you know, the better, looking at the positive aspect of what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I very much appreciate that story. I've said to teachers over the years when it's been time to write IEPs and there's that section in there about the student's strengths. And I always would, you know, have my strength if I knew the child well enough, but I would also ask their gen ed teacher. And so many times I would hear a gen ed teacher say, there's nothing good about that kid.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Has no strength.
$1 for every time I've heard that one. Right. Nothing.
Right.
You don't have any strengths. Yeah. Oh, wait a minute.
Right. And so I'd always say, well, then you need to look at them with different eyes because they have positives. They have lots of strengths. You just need to take a second and change your thinking.
Exactly.
And then you can see the positives. Yes, there are some negatives. The toast is burned, but you could scrape that off. You could add jelly. You could, you know, do a different piece of toast. I mean, there's lots of different things that can go on that you can change your situation, change that perspective, which is actually one of the reasons why I do hashtag no limits, because I want to give exposure, because for me, that's what changed my desire to only want to teach gen ed primary to being so passionate about special education mm-hmm. was I had exposure to students who were the special education students. And I started to say those kids, because that's the title of the book, Those Who Can't Teach. Mm-hmm. excuse me. And it's that exposure. It's that being able to change your mind, to shift your thinking, to say, look at all the great things. Look at all the possibilities. Look at all the potential limits, which is where the title comes from. I heard so many teachers when I was full-time teaching say to me, this family or that kid will never, won't ever, can't do, and all these negative things. And I hated to hear that, because when we were saying to a five-year-old, you'll never go to college.
Yeah, I know.
That's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. And it's heartbreaking.
You'll never be successful.
It's heartbreaking that people make those judgments.
Yes.
I mean, rather than looking at all of the possibilities that are there.
Yes. So in the next few minutes, can you share some of the success stories of students? And you're only going to be able to share, share a few, because we don't have that much time left. But I know you'll have a few at least that you can share.
Right. Actually, you know, I worked with a young lady for a number of years, and she had quite the repertoire of behaviors. And I kept telling her, she's bright, and I kept telling her how she could do anything she put her mind to. And she has a master's degree plus now. And runs a clinic.
Nice.
So, you know, just one of the examples. And, you know, because I live in a small community, I still keep in contact mm-hmm. with a number of my students who thought people would think, oh, they can't possibly do anything. They could do right. a lot. If we built in that opportunity for success for them and let them know that we believed in them. I think that that is such
yes.
an important piece. I know there was a young man and we had to coach him through his job because he had difficulty because some people would love to set him up.
Right.
To get him in trouble in the work environment. And we would role play and all of that. He still has that job and is very successful in the community. So it's those little things that really do make a big difference if we just believe in the children and we communicate that belief and that acceptance of them. And let them know what they can do and all of the ways they can be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with all of that. As I said, we just have a few more minutes. I do have your website up on the screen. It is BevJohns, BevJohns.org. And I'm going to quickly share it with our audience that is watching this on
And I'm actually in the process of updating something.
Oh, okay.
of the material. So, but that'll give you some information about, because I love to write. And so I love to write about my work. I'm doing a new book that is finished and is now in copy editing on oppositional defiant disorders. Because we have more children in schools with oppositional defiant disorders. And what we know now is it's really an emotional regulation problem. They can't regulate their emotions. And, do we jump to conclusions with children?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, especially oppositional, because they are difficult for school folks. And school folks tend to get into power struggles with them. And power struggles don't work.
No.
And you think you're the adult. So you need to regulate yourself and model how to regulate for children. The other project that I'm working on is an edited book, and it is Art as a Restorative Practice, And so hopefully it will be out in 2025 also. But it's a collection of ways that we can use the arts. I'm a firm believer. It really upsets me when schools cut budgets and they cut the art program. Well,
yeah.
A lot of children have to have a way to express themselves.
Yep.
And so they can do it through art, or they can do it through music or drama. So a dance is another one. So, mm-hmm. you know, that's another thing, looking at ways that we can give children outlets yes. for their emotions. You know, we all have probably found outlets. I say mm-hmm. I never wrote poetry until the pandemic, and I wrote poetry during the pandemic because that was an outlet for me.
Right.
So we all need those, which is another thing that I think we've learned a lot about mindfulness. And mm-hmm. the bottom line is we do need to teach children how to regulate their own emotions.
Yeah. Yep. Again, I agree wholeheartedly because of what you said, there's so much research and I do, here in Illinois, our teachers are required to get 120 mm-hmm. hours every 5 years, but I know that's not the case in all states. Once you get a degree in a lot of states, that's it. There's nothing more required of you. But if we're going to be models to our students about learning and we tell them it's so important to be lifelong learners, then we need to model that. And we need to be, you know, finding the research and looking at things. And yeah, sometimes it's, you think some things are a little crazy and you're not really sure. So don't jump on every single bandwagon that comes by, but, you know, give it some time, look at your own research, do a little bit of your own stuff, but also some of those things that you're not comfortable with are the things that are going to help you grow the most. And again, that's kind of something that we tell students. Well, I know it's hard, but just keep pushing through and you'll get it and you'll figure it out and it'll help you grow and it'll be all good. But then we don't do that as adults a lot of times.
That's true. That's true. Well, think about time management as an example. Mm-hmm. So adults spend a fortune on finding the right, you know, time keeping device that they can have. When you think not everything works for one person, and we need to teach those skills much earlier to children so that they're not adults trying to say, oh my gosh, I don't know how to manage my time and I'm going to lose my job, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what is it that I wish I had the tools early on. And I think that that's really important for, you know, individuals in the schools to work on giving children the tools that they're going to need to be successful in life.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Bev, again, thank you so much for being my guest today. It has been an absolute pleasure to chat with you, to get to know you even better than I already do. And I know that there are going to be great nuggets that my audience will take away from this. And again, if you want to reach out to Bev, it's bevjohns.org. Make sure that you reach out to her if you're having difficulty figuring out students in your classroom or figuring out your own child, and pick up one of her books. She has 26 fiction books and 4 nonfiction books.
No, 26 nonfiction.
I had it right the first time.
And 4 or 5 fiction that are fun books. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So check her out. She's a wealth of knowledge. She's a beautiful person inside and out. I just can't speak highly enough of you.
Likewise to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you. And make sure those of you who are watching that you like and subscribe so that you don't miss an episode of Hashtag No Limits. Keep changing the world one person at a time and believing that you can be something different than you are today. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thanks for everybody.
Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelley Keno, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelley Keno is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shelleykeno.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shelleykeno.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.